Today's program has been brought to you by Artisanal Imports, an importer of specialty beers from England, Germany, Belgium, and beyond. For more information, visit www.artisanalimports.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your host for tonight's episode and every episode. So we're live every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. on HeritageRadio.org. You can also find us archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org as well as iTunes.
That's right. And we air out in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick with a live studio audience that pays no attention to us at all through the glass. Busy eating, and it's delicious. Here, you should come.
So that's true. It is delicious. Roberta's Pizza. So let's start with a few announcements. So I think we mentioned this last time, but I'm teaching my first introduction to homebrewing class at Brooklyn Kitchen on Thursday, April 11th at 6 p.m. It starts at 6 p.m., and it goes for around 2 hours, 2.5 hours. It's $145, and that gets you the full instruction, plus they serve some samples of beer, and you get a full kit, homebrewing kit, so that you can start brewing as soon as you get home.
That's awesome. How much is the kit generally at Brooklyn Homebrew, do you know?
It says it's an $80 value.
That's cool.
So, yeah, so it's a pretty good deal. And if you just go to Brooklyn Kitchen website, to their classes, you can find it on there, so... If you're interested in learning to homebrew, you've never done it before, maybe you've done it and you need some more encouragement, I would invite you to join me on April 11th at Brooklyn Kitchen. The next announcement is Brooklyn Homebrew has a brand new Pro Brew Kit. It's their Captain Lawrence Brewing Company's Liquid Gold clone. And they offer it in both partial mash and all grain. So I think that's pretty interesting. That's a great local brewery. That's a really delicious beer. So if you'd like to brew your very own version, head to Brooklyn Homebrew and pick up their kit.
These kind of projects are really fun, I think, because you really get to know your own brewing process and what your brewing system and what kind of happens. So if you actually get a Captain Lawrence Liquid Gold in the bottle and then brew your own and, you know, taste the difference, you can see what kind of things are going on in your brew house, and you can make the proper adjustments to make that happen.
Absolutely. And it's also maybe if you like brewing pale ales or stouts or porters and you've maybe never done a Belgian, or you're just getting into Belgians, this might be a good introduction to them. And you might learn some new techniques and materials.
New techniques and materials. I'm excited about our project that we did recently. We did a sour kettle mash. I think we talked a lot about it last week.
Yep.
But if you are in town in the beginning of April, we will be launching our Berliner Weiss, the Pillow Talk Series number 1 at 508 Gastro Brewery. Super excited about it.
Yep. And we'll let you know that date when we come back. We're headed to CBC this week, so
what's the CBC, Mary?
Craft Brewers Conference. So Chris is going to represent 508 Gastro Brewing at the Craft Brewers Conference. It's a professional conference for brewers and related industry. So importers, distributors, bar owners, brew pubs, nano breweries, large breweries, everybody.
Anybody in the professional beer scene, from writers to retail to wholesale to buying to making.
Yep.
Yada, yada.
And they have informational seminars about all kinds of things from, you know, point of sale systems to sour brewing. So both technical brewing and you know, more business type discussions.
And for breweries and planning too, if you're not in not in the business yet and you would like to be learning more and, you know, helping start your business, they do a lot of seminars on that too. So if you are thinking about starting one, it's probably too late to go this week. It starts kind of day after tomorrow. Tomorrow is the reception, our opening reception. But think about it for next year and go and learn. Hi, Jaren. How you doing? just real quick about the CBC. I went to the CBC for the first time about 3 years ago when it was in Chicago. And it was my first CBC. And it was just amazing seeing the camaraderie and the love in this beer scene and in the professional beer scene. It was just absolutely beautiful to see brothers in arms, because we're still a very small part of the market and everybody's fighting the good fight for flavor.
Yep.
And quality.
And there's also some really amazing after events going on at local bars, which I'm excited about. That's always a good place to mix with some of the brewers as well, make new friends. Anyway, we're excited about that.
You know what I'm excited about?
What?
Today's episode.
Awesome. What are we talking about today, Chris?
Oh, I was downstairs in 508 a few weeks back, or like actually, I think in the first 2 weeks that I was working there, and you know, somebody came downstairs and like, hey, you know, there's this guy upstairs who used to brew beer at this place called Deschutes and wanted to say hello, and I was like, what? Deschutes? I love Deschutes. What's going on with that? And who is this guy? Came up and met our guest tonight, Joe Pedicini. How you doing, Joe?
Very good, thanks.
We want to get closer to the mic, and then we can all hear you. Yeah.
Hello, everybody.
Joe Pedicini now is in the wine business and has Monte Bruno Wines.
That's right, out in Oregon.
Oregon. Yep. Do you spend all of your time in Oregon?
I don't, actually. I grew up here on the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey and moved out to Oregon in 1992 originally to follow the passion that I had for brewing beer, actually, and started out like a lot of us do as a home brewer, and decided I wanted to make the leap as a professional brewer, and traveled to the West Coast to try my luck and seeing if I get hired at some of my favorite breweries from out there. In doing so, I met a lot of great people, had a lot of fun in the brewing industry, but also fell in love with Pinot Noir out there.
That's awesome. So, How long had you been homebrewing before going out there?
About 4 years, actually.
4 years?
Yeah. And what got you started in homebrewing?
We had a lot of carboys and equipment lying around the house because my grandparents and parents made wine as a hobby. So we had a lot of equipment available. And I enjoyed the winemaking process, but I was at that age where I was really interested in brewing, interested in beer drinking also, mm-hmm. obviously. But I think it was because I took a trip out west and tasted something like maybe some old Pete's Wicked Ale or Sierra Nevada or something mm-hmm. like that, and came back east and you couldn't find anything yep. like that. So a lot of us back then decided to brew because we were trying to sort of capture a taste that wasn't available here on the East Coast.
Not mm-hmm. to date you, but what year yeah. is back then?
Well, it was the late 80s when I first
started. It was the late 80s. That's yeah. awesome. That's The New York City Home Brewers Guild started around 1987, 1988, and we're
That's
celebrating
right.
our 25th year right now, and a lot of those people were brewing for the exact same reasons. You know, you couldn't get a lot of these different beers, and you know, that spawned this revolution that
the,
is thriving.
The club used to have meetings at a place, Lower East Side, called Brewskies,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't exist anymore. But
but we still meet at the same place for the most part. Brewskies, they were still meeting at Brewskies when I started in 2001, and then we moved. They went under different ownership, turned Brewskies into a place called Standings. Now we're right next door, but
yep.
it's, you know, since then it's still been in relatively the same,
very cool.
same spot.
Yeah. And we still have our steering committee meetings actually every month or so at Standings.
The artist formerly known as Brewskies.
Yeah,
very cool. it's a sort of a special spot. The you know, the linear mark is...
Were you part of the guild at that time?
I was not. We were just kind of... we had stumbled into the place because, you know, going back again to this time when, you know, Beck's Dark was sort of an exotic beer back then. You know?
Yeah.
And Brewskies at the time had the entire lineup of Anchor Steam beers.
Whoa.
I mean, Liberty, the Wheat, the Foghorn,
that's
all the time.
That's impressive.
Really? Yeah, that is impressive. It's amazing.
And it was all really fresh and delicious. And we didn't really understand what was going on because you couldn't find those beers in other places in town. But Brewskies had them. And so, you know, it was sort of, we found it, I guess, luck or some sort of a magnetic reaction or something like that. Yeah.
And where did you get your homebrew supplies back then?
Milan Labs, which was in downtown New York. I don't even remember. I think it was on Canal Street or something like that. I don't remember.
Yep. But, I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I wonder when that closed.
I don't know.
It was a fun place to visit. It was kind of, they had their own way of organizing things, so, you know, it took a little while to find things. but
what did you like to brew when you were brewing before moving out west? And did you go out, when you went out west, did you bring a bunch of your home brew to in hopes of, you know, taking that as samples to try and get a job in the industry?
Well, I did, and I also, I did a lot of research, and I did a lot of experimentation with brewing and with trying to grow my own yeast cultures and things like that. So I, by the time I was ready to dive in, I was, you know, pretty knowledgeable. And there were a lot of folks that were starting out in the industry, and they kind of wanted to go the route of, you know, getting in and maybe washing kegs for a little while and then sort of advancing into the brew house. But I really had my, you know, sights set on getting into the brew house. So I did as much preparation as I could. And I did an internship here at a place at the time called Zip City.
Yep.
That was a really neat little little Austrian brew house with a double decoction mash tun. And
now, who did, was the brewer there?
A guy named Bob Berg.
Okay.
And so he had
not
actually...
Not the saxophonist Bob Berg.
No, no, a different one, a different one. Okay. Bob may have played sax too, I don't know. But he had just gotten back from Siebel and was classmates with some folks that were out west. So, you know, I had done this internship with Bob, and I was able to kind of, you know, drop some names while I was out there. And so a lot of trial and error, and I found I wound up, you know, I really kind of zeroed in on Deschutes because I love the area. Central Oregon is one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Yeah, it is.
And I really liked the beers also very much at the time.
Yeah.
The sort of that you asked about what styles we were making. I mean, that sort of Northwestern Cascade influenced pale ale was, you know, especially at the time, it was something really special.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely, we absolutely take that for granted these days, but you know, Sierra Nevada is still, you know, just amazing.
Although I think now, though, with all the hops, like we're drinking this Eastern Standard, which I find kind of juicy in this tropical fruit way.
Yes,
it's absolutely delicious from Peekskill Brewery with the brewmaster Jeff O'Neill up there, and it's probably my, I think it's become my favorite East Coast IPA. It just came to New York City a few weeks ago, I think, somewhere right around New York Craft Beer Week.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely delicious. But now, I mean, we have these IPAs made with Nelson Sauvin hops and Sirachi Ace and all these other kind of more exotic hops. And so I think actually Cascade is pale, you know, pale ale with just Cascade.
It's
kind of
back,
becoming
man.
Special
it's
again.
Back. It's like a novelty.
People have been doing all this experiment, and I think, you know, that's going to continue. But I think some people have gone back to their kind of American hop roots. So...
I think so. I mean, there's so many new varieties out there that just pack such a punch. And,
yeah. And have some flavors that we haven't seen in hops before.
Yes, yes.
So, which is one thing I'm excited about. Craft Brewers Conference, we always get to go see what new hop varieties are coming onto the market.
Yeah, it's always exciting.
Yeah.
And a lot of these super high alpha hops that have these wonderful aromatics also that make it real easy for... you know, for making these IPAs that are popular and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
that are really bitter.
Yeah, or that have, you know, in the old days it took a lot of hop flowers to,
right.
you know, get that kind of flavor punch.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, so a lot of these new varieties are fun to use for in the brew house too because they're a little bit less labor intensive.
Yeah, that's true. So when you, you were hired at Deschutes, how did that come about or what'd you start as? How did you start there?
I started in the brew house. You know, they were in the process of an expansion, and so they were taking the current brew house, which was actually the brew pub, and they were going to that I think had an 8-barrel brew house that was being pushed to 10 or 12 barrels or something like that, and they were bringing in a new JV Northwest 50-barrel system.
Oh, wow.
Across town, so they had you know, when I started there, basically ground had just been broken, and so they had started the long process of starting the new brew house, and they knew that they'd need a whole new brewing team and so forth. So they started looking and interviewing people and so forth.
Cool.
And basically, it was good timing, and I got there, I felt really lucky because I was able to spend, you know, the first year there mostly working in the brew house. Which was on a much smaller scale.
Right, the smaller...
Yeah.
Before they expanded.
The brew pub. The brew pub.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
The 8-barrel system?
It was an 8-barrel system, but we had, you know, we were maxing it out so that we could...
fill 12-barrel fermenters?
We could meet the demand that folks were looking for, yeah. So even the kettle was, you know, pushed as high as it could go. And
right.
We were sort of doing the best we could to get the beer out to these markets up in Portland and Seattle that were just dying for it and couldn't get enough.
That's awesome. We're going to take a really quick break,
yep.
And when we come back, we'll talk more about your experience there and
cool.
how that transferred over to wine and the love of Pinot Noir.
Artisanal Imports is an importer of specialty beers from England, Germany, Belgium, and beyond. Their portfolio of fine ales and lagers is broad and represents a wide range of beer styles, but it is not their mission to collect every small brewery across Europe. They believe in working in full partnership with their breweries and are careful to select beers that are high quality and interesting, but that do not overlap one to the next. For more information, visit www.artisanalimports.com.
Hey, welcome back to Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here with our special guest, Joe Pedicini of Monte Bruno Wines. Hi, Joe.
Hello there.
And we've been talking about how Joe started out homebrewing and then in Jersey and then moved out west, got a job at Deschutes.
That's right.
When it was still just a brew pub before they built their production brewery.
That's correct.
How long were they in production at that at the time that you joined 13 before they joined?
I think they started in 86 or 87.
86. Yeah.
They were one of the early ones in Oregon also.
Yeah,
that's... And what were the flagship beers that you guys were brewing at the time? We don't even get Deschutes in New York, so I've had it when I go out west, or I think you can get it, you know,
and it's still
kind of close to here.
Beer.
Oh, yeah,
it's
fantastic.
Not that I had it back then, but I know that it's one of my favorites.
That's always one when I was in Vegas a couple months ago, and I made sure to have several Deschutes while I was out there, because they really are great.
Well, they do a good job. They at the time, it was Black Butte Porter was their big sort of flagship beer. And... we were doing a few that unfortunately aren't in the their repertoire anymore. They kind of grew out of them, and you know, those are the ones that I kind of you know, those are just memories, and those are the real special ones. There was one called Bachelor Bitter that was just mostly on draft, just at the pub, and we had a lot of fun playing around with that, especially in cask format, and you know, dry hopping the hell out of them.
And that's awesome.
I love that.
And back then, man, not that many people were doing casks. I can't imagine.
No.
So
no, just a few, just a few. So it was a lot. It was a lot of fun. We were kind of we were doing a lot of experimentation and really kind of feeling, you know, like Chris had mentioned, being at the Craft Brewers Conference and the feeling of camaraderie and sort of this this sense of sort of a fraternalness with brewers, and it's really a wonderful thing that has been going on as far back as I can remember in the country here, and it still seems very strong. It still
Absolutely.
Seems like
oh yeah,
people, you know, you're traveling through the country, and you work in the brewing industry, and you stop by a brewery, and you know, say hi, and you're friendly. Pretty soon, you're probably going to be meeting some people that work there and making new friends, and that's just how it goes.
Absolutely, that's how you're yeah. here.
Exactly.
We've had to say hello. It's pretty awesome and pretty fun, and I can't wait to brew with you over there. I think we talked a little bit about doing a collaboration at some point.
That'd be
and
fun.
I would absolutely love to do that. Maybe we could do a Bachelor Bitter.
Well, we slightly tweak the name, maybe. But also, you were saying you wanted to experiment with some. Beers fermented or matured in oak, and
absolutely,
yeah. I have some barrels that are in good shape that I could pass along.
Absolutely, want to do that. And I'd absolutely also would like to use some Pinot Noir grapes. What is the character of Pinot Noir grapes?
Well, you know, it varies, but I've never heard of anybody using them in the brewing process. Would you be using them?
I would want the fermentables, so I'd do it like a portion, almost like a Braggot, but on the wine side kind of thing. And people have been starting to do that. We, Mary and I, we tasted some beers from Switzerland, or was it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the other day. So some saisons, two saisons that were both. It was both the same base saison. One of them fermented with white grapes, and the other fermented with I think Cabernet grapes, or
I can't remember the exact grape, but
it was
they
delicious.
Were both
interesting.
It was
really awesome and really fun.
And then Garrett Oliver over at Brooklyn Brewery has been, he does a lot of stuff with Red Hook Winery barrels, and also he's used their leaves
to,
you know, he leaves the leaves in there, and he's done I think some yeast experimentations with them too, using some of their yeast. So, you know, those are a couple that we can think of, but
yeah, and I'd love to have fun doing all that stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's, I think there's more places in the world than we realize where there's crossovers between the brewing and the winemaking fields, and it, you know, the two just have a lot in common, and there's that same sort of family quality that you have in the wine industry also with people that can appreciate what you're doing because they do the same thing, you know, they're toiling in the cellars and. Or whether it's being a brewer and having to dig out the mash, you know what it's like, and you know what it's like to sort of experiment with a new beer and worry about it as it's fermenting and stuff. This is all stuff that, you know, the average folks don't really understand what we go through.
That's true. Now, speaking of, I have been to some Oregon wineries years ago, and I remember hearing in some other, you know, what other wineries in other parts of the country, but I always hear that when they do harvest, that they always, you have beer as kind of the drink for, you know, their harvest drinks.
Well, I think it's almost like a cliche now, but it does take a lot of beer to make good wine.
That's
a lot of truth to that.
A lot of beer to make good wine.
So let's talk about how you moved from brewing at Deschutes into wine making.
Well, really, it was, you know, like I sort of touched on in the beginning, my parents made wine at home, so there was, it was sort of an important part of our annual sort of cycle of life, and so we, it was something that I had been exposed to from a very young age. So it was really just as much of a part of who I am as the brewing side was.
Right.
And so I think it was just a function of the Pinot Noir that I found in Oregon was just something that really moved me.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking a little bit about, Chris had asked, you know, what sort of flavor characteristic will Pinot Noir possibly bring to a beer? And it's hard to say sort of what varietal characteristics Pinot Noir has. It does have sort of cherry, and it does have some earthiness and maybe raspberry flavors. But what makes Pinot Noir unique is that it tastes of a place.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to Oregon and growing Pinot Noir in the Willamette Valley, it tastes of the Willamette Valley, and it's a sort of a special place. And that's what makes it sort of what it is. And that's why. When it comes to places like Burgundy, the grape grown there is Pinot Noir, and it's so sought after and so expensive because it tastes of a really special place, and it's been grown there for so many hundreds of years that it really has the ability to sort of transport you to that place, no
mm-hmm.
matter where you are in the world drinking this wine. And I feel that we have something. It's not the same, but it's still very exciting
mm-hmm.
in Oregon, and so that's something that. Just kind of grabbed a hold of me.
Right. Makes sense. Now, when did the wine industry in the Willamette Valley kind mm-hmm. of come into its own, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Well,
I mean, it's been there for a while.
Yeah, some of the older vineyards were planted in the mid and late 60s. So, yeah, it's been around for quite a while. And it's kind of hard to say. I think that they both kind of grew it around the same time. There's a lot of... again, that same sort of feeling of camaraderie. There was a lot of that going on, crossing over the boundaries of wine and beer, and even food and sort of focus on regional delicacies in Oregon. That was all kind of happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene in general there right now is just amazing.
Yeah.
It was always really cool, but compared to what it was in 1992, it's really grown incredibly.
Yeah.
Wonderful restaurants, wonderful culture, wonderful wines, beers, and...
spirits. There's a lot of distillers.
A lot
micro
of great distillers
in Portland.
Yeah. And not to mention all of the great mushroom producers and great vegetable growers, everything.
Yeah. So lots of local... I haven't been to Portland... Well, actually, the only time I've been to Portland was back in 2007. I went to the Oregon Brewers Fest. But even back then, and then we, again, I think we were there for 4 days. We hit a bunch of brewery and brew pubs on our first day, and then did the Oregon Brewers Fest. But we actually, one of the last days, we did a wine country tour. So I think we hit a couple of breweries and then maybe three wineries. But it was absolutely amazing to see. We did go to some nice restaurants and... it was an incredible scene then, and I know, from what I read and hear about, it's even more so now.
Yeah,
so.
You can't travel very far in Oregon without hitting a good, interesting brewery.
Yeah.
The restaurants are following right along. So.
Yeah.
There's this whole movement now with the area around Bend, Central Oregon, where they're saying now that there's more breweries per capita in that region than there are in Portland.
Portland.
And Portland sort of started
wow.
it all.
Yeah.
But a lot of these guys that are, they worked in larger breweries for a while, and then they kind of spun off to do their own thing.
Right.
And they're doing, a handful of barrels a year, but they're doing really interesting, time-consuming, high-quality, expensive beers.
Yeah.
And they're finding a market for them. It's really exciting.
Yeah. And that was the other thing is... when we were at the Oregon Brewers Fest, we had tons of IPAs, you know, mm-hmm. pale ale and IPA, very Northwest hoppy pale ales and IPAs. And there weren't actually, at that time, there weren't a whole lot of other styles. But when we were going around town, we actually went to Hair of the Dog, had an open house that mm-hmm. same day we went there. That was absolutely incredible. And Alan's been doing, you know, unusual barrel-aged and you know, not IPA styles for a long time. I mean, he does a very good pale ale as well. But now, reading, I mean, there's Cascade. There's a lot of people doing some very kind of cutting-edge experimental stuff out there. Yeah. I know there's other ones that are just not coming to mind right now, but that's pretty exciting.
And that was exemplified also when we went to the National Homebrew Conference last year, too.
Oh, yeah, Seattle.
You know, we were expecting to see a lot of, you know, high-octane IPAs from Northwest, and it was actually a well-rounded diversity of...
Yep, both for club night and pro night. So, because a lot of clubs, I mean, there were a lot of local Washington clubs, but a lot of the clubs had come up from Oregon, Central Oregon, Western Oregon. And that, actually, that was, club night was absolutely, so club night at the National Homebrewers Conference is just where each club has a booth and serves, you know, anywhere between like eight and 42 beers. I mean, it's
a beer festival that's by the fans, for the fans.
And they don't have to deal with, you know, sort of, market needs or wants,
exactly.
So they just do what they like, and it's a lot of fun.
We actually had some mushroom beer. I think we had shiitake mushroom beer, maybe. We had a smoked apple blonde that was made, it was just a traditional blonde, but the guy had smoked apples and then added the smoked apples at the end of his boil, and it was delicious. But, you know, things like that
the Mountain Dew
you would never
beer.
See.
It's pretty interesting.
Yes.
20% Mountain Dew.
That was at the Big Lebowski booth. There was a club that had a Big Lebowski theme. So.
You gotta wear your bathrobe, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Real quick, because we're actually running out of time. This is part one of two episodes, and today we're talking more about Joe's beer life. But before we officially leave, when did you leave, and how did you start Monte Bruno?
Oh, so I had moved back to the East Coast and spent some time out here. I decided that I wanted to produce Pinot Noir, started doing some experimenting. Long story short, my first commercial vintage was
2003.
Yeah. That's pretty fun. Yeah. And you've been doing it since, and it's going well.
It's going really well.
It's delicious. Yeah. We were at
a natural wine tasting.
Natural wine tasting, and your were awesome.
Yeah, actually, they were one of our favorite, for sure.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, we're really excited about, again, like what Oregon gives us, you know, the gift from Mother Nature in Oregon is really something special.
Yeah. So that is it for today's show. Tune in next Monday, April 1st, for part two with Joe. We're going to talk more about, you know, about his entry into winemaking, kind of about winemaking, because Chris and I don't know much about it.
That's
we're
true.
Betting if you're a home brewer, you don't either. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk more about making wine and then
what natural wine is.
Yep. And all that.
Fermentation vessels, temperatures. La la la.
So join us again at 7 p.m. Monday, April 1st for part two.
On Fermented Island.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.